You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Monster Talk is supported by listeners like you. Find out how you can contribute via Patreon or with reviews at monstertalk.org/support. Your contributions, large or small, make a huge difference. Thanks.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and this is a special Patreon bonus episode that was set up by Matthew Baxter, who has himself been on the show several times as a guest. Together, we had the opportunity to interview a man who is a director, an artist, a writer, and many other things beside, Larry Blamire. Over the course of our discussion, we mentioned quite a few movies and other projects, and I've tried to put links to all that in the show notes at monstertalk.org and on Patreon at patreon.com/monstertalk. So let's get on to the
Monster Talk.
We're excited to welcome Larry Blamire here to Monster Talk. But who is Larry Blamire? To answer that question, we brought on Larry Blamire.
Well, it's too bad you don't have an expert, because then he could tell you right away. To the best of my knowledge, I am a writer, director, artist, playwright, actor. So I dabble in a lot of things. But most folks know me for a film called The Lost Skeleton of Kadabra, which was released by Sony in 2004. And then we did several other films in that sort of genre, which was a kind of gentle spoof of old 50s black and white sci-fi movies. And I'm also a painter, and I've been a science fiction illustrator, so I've worn a lot of hats, and that requires a lot of heads. The end.
Nice. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Matthew, I should welcome you too.
Well, thank you. Right off, I have to say, geez, Larry, get a job. What?
Don't you mean pick a job?
Yeah. Well, does that make you an auteur? I saw that word the other day, and I thought, do I really know what that means? And I looked it up, and it sounded like someone who wants to have control over every aspect.
Yeah, I've been referred to as that.
Yeah.
Because I do on the films that I've made and short films, I have done quite the writing, the directing, and I will sometimes act in them also. So yeah, I guess it is very auteurish.
Cool. Congratulations. That makes you the first self-described auteur we've had on.
Oh. Really?
Yeah.
We'll just refer to you as a micromanager.
The closest I've come before, I think, was when I went to Olive Garden and had a tour of Italy. You're quite creative. I should have warned you there would be puns. My apologies if that's an issue. So you've created monsters for paintings, comic books, film, and I know you probably get this a lot, but how do you come up with the different kinds of creatures you use in your works?
Yeah,
I want to in particular think we've got a lot of people in the audience who are also creative, and sometimes, you know, they're just looking for
guidance or a little nudge, you know, you can do it. I think having somebody on like yourself is going to be really great for that. But when you answer this question, I guess we don't mean like, where do you get your ideas? But really, literally, like, what are the best techniques for like generating ideas like that in the monster space?
A lot of the monsters I come up with in paintings or in my movies are sort of riffs on things that I saw as a kid, because I was just absorbing all of the monster movies I could. I think the gateway monster for me, and probably for a lot of other kids too, is the dinosaur. I mean, kids discover dinosaurs, and it's just a very strange thing, because what they were real, they were walking around. I mean, that's phenomenal. And from there, you know, dinosaurs lead to so many other monsters. But I particularly like, especially in paintings, going with things that are against nature, like sort of asymmetrical monsters, where you've got because, you know, nature has such symmetry. So when you do a monster with, you know, with two eyes on one side and one way up in the corner, I mean, that kind of stuff, that the more grotesque, the better. And I think I like to create creatures that really kind of make people just sort of shake their head and worry about me.
Of course, all kids really love dinosaurs. But when did your passion for monster movies actually begin?
Seeing them on TV was such a revelation. I mean, King Kong used to run a lot when I was a kid on TV, and that was certainly one of the first that I saw. And then the films of Ray Harryhausen, I to this day I love stop motion animation, and I just think it's fantastic. It's got such a solidity to it, and there can be some good CGI, but I love the stop motion. And so I think those were probably the ones that sort of first pulled me in, the stop motion creatures, and it creates such a strange reality. You know, it's fascinating.
It does. I think Harryhausen and Bradbury, who were both lifelong friends and collaborators, mm-hmm. Both also got their start in dinosaurs. I mean, that was their gateway monster as well. I think I bet that's true for a lot of our listeners. I think what you mentioned stop motion. One of the cool things about the stop motion stuff is how well it holds up on Blu-ray in these high def formats. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of the CGI stuff, I don't know if this is true so much anymore, but you know, back in the day, it seemed like you could tell a difference in the pixel density between when there was a CGI effect and the sort of the film stock of the actual, you know, main screen. And I don't see that issue in stop motion so much. It looks so I love practical effects.
I do too. And yeah. I think the solidity of practical effects, whether it's a man in a suit or a stop motion puppet or an animatronic creation, I think it creates more of a sense of wonder. And that's what drew me in as a kid. It's pulling me into a certain world. And now there's so much. I mean, when you see a typical shot in a movie these days, especially a fantasy film or science fiction or something, the entire world kind of looks, nothing looks real. Nothing looks real. And I'm just not too keen on that. I mean, I don't accept that as a reality. It's not pulling me in. It's making me think, oh, there's some really nice artwork right there. But it doesn't draw me in.
You're known for The Lost Skeleton of the Cadaver, but that's not all that you've been doing. And we'll talk about some of your current stuff as well during this interview. But I was curious about when you created that, were you thinking, I want this to look like a low-budget movie because it has to be a low-budget movie? Or that sort of B-1950s style, 1960s style? What were you thinking, like, what were you emulating, and what really makes a great film of that style in your mind?
Well, you know, that was a case of really the budget was driving the idea, which was driving the budget. So it was like, we're going to try to convincingly make something that looks like, and originally we thought we'd make maybe like a lost movie, you know, that was discovered. So we want it to look as authentically 1950s low budget as possible. That really works out for your actual budget, which was low budget. It wasn't, you know, really was a low budget movie. So we're really cutting corners now. That, you know, having said that, there is a heightened sense of absurdity absurdity is one of my driving passions. I just love the absurd, and really the Lost Girl and the Cadaver is an excuse. The old movie is a framework for absurdity.
Yeah. You know, I think it's obvious that a lot of things influence you there. I was thinking about some of the Corman movies. You know, I don't know if you've read his biography, but it's his autobiography, I guess I should say. It's so interesting because, you know, he doesn't – his was about making money, like being efficient, like spending less and making more, right? And but he did a great job, and when he actually got more money, he did better production quality, right? But I was thinking about that style, the sort of, you know, constrained by what you had when you made this. Now, you made this in, I think, 2001, right? And it shot on videotape, right?
Yes.
And so I know a lot of people that I meet who are curious how to break into this sort of work. Can you talk a little bit about the changes in technology between 2001 and now? Because it feels like right now people are carrying around better cameras in their pockets on the cheapest phone than I ever had access to back then.
There's no question about it. But, you know, ultimately my feeling is that the technology doesn't matter. For instance, you can frame your shots in a certain way. If you're trying to make something look like an old movie, you can frame your shots in a certain way that lends itself to that. And then you can direct the actors in a certain way that makes that happen too. I guess I'm saying that to me, the technology doesn't matter too much. When we made a few years later, we made Trail of the Screaming Forehead, and that has a whole different look. It's got a sort of widescreen, candy Technicolor sort of look to it. And we had a much better camera at that time. So that lent itself to that look. I think access has never been better, and that's a good thing because it does mean that you can make a movie with your phone now. And really it's so much about the storytelling that I don't think the technology is going to change that fact.
It does feel that way, though. I mean, I see some of the stuff my wife shoots on her phone's camera. Mm. Some of the quality of the stuff she shoots looks as good as stuff I see on, you know, high-end television or movies. It's just, I mean, it's really, I mean, for a cat video, they're amazing.
It's true. Well, yeah, it is. It's gotten ridiculous. I mean, we are definitely carrying around in our pockets something better than we shot Lost Skeleton with. That is a good thing. I mean, it really does mean that the kids can get into filmmaking a lot earlier than they might normally have. I know some who started making films as kids and making videos as kids, and it's great.
You know, you talk about the low budget of a lot of these movies, but you actually have some pretty darn good actors in your movies. You know, Faye Masterson and Brian Howe and Jim Beaver.
Yeah.
What are you paying them with?
What do you mean paying? I don't know what you're talking about, man.
Exposure!
Even though Lost Girl and the Cadaver cost very little, we did do it on a very low budget SAG contract, right? Because most of us working on that were SAG actors at the time. We are working within that confine. A couple of the cast weren't SAG, but as far as the people, you mentioned the quality. You couldn't have a better stock company. I'm just so fortunate to work with folks like this. A lot of them came. A number of them came from Boston Theater, where I was working for years as a playwright and director and actor. And so some of the folks were friends of mine from theater, and some of them were new folks in L.A. Brian Howe, who came from Boston along with me, an old buddy of mine, he introduced me to a lot of the folks in L.A. when I got to L.A. that came into our stock company too. So we kind of have a mixture of folks from the East and West Coast.
Yeah, it's the chemistry between all you guys is always fantastic, and it even carries through into you know, Tales from the Pub, and it's a lot of fun to watch you guys work. Now with a lot of these, you know, it seems like you really kind of enjoy that style of the 1950s and that type of monster in these movies. Is there a real reason that you're keeping these kind of monsters alive, that you're keeping them around?
I'm still a kid when it comes to monsters, and I really do love them. And you know, there's been a pleasant surprise of having kids respond to these movies. Not like it's something strange and distant, but they're enjoying it on a different level, and they enjoy the monsters, which are, you know, the monsters in these movies are pretty fairly family friendly, I think. And that's just it's a great thing to keep alive. I mean, I think monsters for me were like, this will sound weird, but monsters are like a sort of gateway drug to existentialism. And by that, I mean that they jar us from a certain complacency, which is why as a kid, I got into, you know, after discovering monsters on TV, I'm then, you know, finding books in the library on the Abominable Snowman, Bigfoot, and the Loch Ness Monster, UFOs and stuff. And that's started a lifelong fascination with that. And I think these, you know, when people have sightings like this, there's a certain jarring from everyday life that actually makes us think about how weird the universe is. Because, I mean, if you're looking at superstring theory and things like that, and quantum physics, I mean, things are weird. I mean, they're weird, you know, multiverse. And these are like, when there's a sighting of a UFO or something, I mean, it's like more concrete, it's a more tangible symbol of that kind of thing. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. It transports us from the mundane to the numinous.
Yes, very nicely done. Nicely said.
Now, I want to talk really, really briefly about your Steam Wars art. I've been lucky enough to get to see some of it. It's really, to me, a huge departure from your films like Lost Skeleton of Cadavera. And some of it kind of even reminds me a little bit. I don't know if you ever saw Queen's album art for News of the World. Had these huge kind of robots that were just monstrous and frightening, but completely indifferent to the people that they were kind of destroying accidentally. What kind of inspired your Steam Wars art?
I think, you know, it's kind of hard to say. But the best I can come up with is that I remember doing a mural in high school that had a lot of things going on in it, and, you know, like crazy surreal sort of things. And there was this giant machine, and it was sort of shaped like as if it was a Greek armor, like kind of like Talos from Jason and the Argonauts, a little bit like that. And that might have been an influence, actually. But there were tiny little people on top of it, and that gave me the idea for this sort of alternate reality, kind of very steampunk kind of reality, where war, everything's the same except war is fought on these giant machines that are manned by a crew. And the adventure that the first adventure I wrote was in the form of a diary kept by a crew member on one of these. And I wanted it to have that kind of POV, and it's kind of, I want it to be kind of gritty and grimy, and we're talking coal-driven machines here that are manned by a crew, but they're in the shape of giant warriors, and so you have some of that Victorian elegance combined with the raw steam power, you know, which is a contrast that I find interesting, and that led me to sort of create this whole world.
Yeah, it seemed like it. Your sense of humor didn't come through nearly as much as this bizarre, stark, you know, alternate reality. And it was really interesting to look at.
Thank you. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's fairly serious. I mean, there's a certain wry humor, the way you find among the, you know, the camaraderie that you find in something like Gunga Din, you know. And, you know, the guys who are griping at having to shovel coal and just that kind of thing. And there's humor in that, but I mean, beyond that, it is pretty much a straightforward action adventure.
Since we had mentioned the Queen Owl, Frank Kelly Frias was the artist on that.
Editor's note, it's actually pronounced like freeze.
On that, on both the Queen cover and the actual, it was actually a takeoff on a Weird Tales cover he'd done years and years before. So he was a longtime old Weird Tales artist. So I'll put some show notes about that too. He's just an interesting character.
He did some great stuff for Mad Magazine too.
Oh, that's awesome. All right. But okay. Speaking of Lost Skeleton of Cadavra, all these years later, are you still finding new fans? Are you hearing from people who are like first just now getting in touch with it?
I never stop hearing from fans.
That's awesome.
I will get, you know, on a weekly basis, a new, you know, a message on Facebook or Twitter, saying how much they love the movie, how much it means to them. And for a lot of people, it's kind of a comfort food. It's kind of a go-to thing. Like I've heard people say, you know, they were kind of down and they put on Lost Skeleton. That's the best feeling. I've had people, this might not sound right, but people ailing have found comfort in the movie too, which I'm very grateful for.
That's great.
And as I mentioned before, kids, kids seem to like it too. So, hey, kids like it too. So,
yeah. one of my friends is a huge fan, and I told him that you were going to be on, and he wanted me to pass this along, which is that he showed this movie to his 9-year-old nephew. And when they got to the line, "Oh, it's you, the idiot," he lost it. And apparently, even all these years later, he just continues to use that line for his uncle there. I don't know if it's to his uncle, but he said he wanted to let you know, thank you so much for that, because it's led to so many fun memories. So.
Thank you for that. That reminds me of another fun thing, which is, and people think I get sick of this, but I don't. People quote from the movie all the time. And apparently there's a number of lines to quote that people remember and say frequently, like around the house. That's very flattering.
That is. Really. That's nice.
Yeah.
A strong mimetic content.
So when you're at like cons and stuff, do people yell these out to you from across the room?
No, they come up to me and yell in my face. and of course, if it's the Lost Skeleton, you've got to yell it because he yells everything.
That's true. Is there a particular fan favorite line that you hear the most often?
I sleep now.
That would probably be it. Yep.
That might be it. I mean, there's a few, but that might be the one I hear.
I was thinking about the influences on Lost Skeleton. Would you say, I mean, were you influenced by Ed Wood, by Roger Corman? Like who did you feel like was the strongest influence?
It was, yeah. And I'm asked this question a lot, and I think my answer is pretty much that I was like a sponge for all these movies and you know, I was watching all kinds of horror movies, but it was those 1950s sci-fi horror movies that really grabbed me for some reason. And so when I wrote Lost Skeleton, which was in a matter of days, it just kind of came out. And I was drawing on all of these movies that I had absorbed over the years. But the most specific thing I would say is the Crowbar and Lattice, the alien couple, are very much inspired by Eros and Tana from Plan 9 from Outer Space. So Ed Wood deserves a lot of credit. And his wonderful language, I mean, there's nothing quite like Ed Wood language. And that was
Stupid minds.
You see? Your stupid minds. Stupid.
Exactly. You know, and that was a big influence on me and on creating a specific kind of language for the film. Not just for the aliens who have a very unique way of talking, but for everybody, you know. And I love words. I'm a word guy. I love words.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
I have to tell you, Larry, the other normal co-host for this show, Karen Stolzno, she tends to hate everything, but she really, really loves your wordplay that you write. She's a PhD linguist, and she absolutely loves the wordplay that you have. So she has watched everything.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
Now, with the Lost Skeleton, the Lost Skeleton himself is the main antagonist. And then you've got, of course, Anomala, you got Dr. Roger Fleming, and then you got the mutant himself as this extra bad guy. Now, was it a kind of a common tactic in these 1950s B films to kind of have a team of bad guys, even if they weren't on the same team?
You know, he's kind of, I think it's a very touching finale for him, though. And I think that he sort of can't help it. I think it's Betty that says that, And so he's sort of a mixed bag. I think he's somewhat sympathetic, whereas the skeleton is not at all. I mean, we essentially have two monsters in the movie: the mutant, with a great costume built by my friend Courtney Skinner, and the skeleton himself, who is probably the cheapest movie monster you could come up with. I mean, it's a skeleton, you know. So. Right. Plastic. And I wasn't quite thinking of this intentionally until I got to the end of it that it was, you know, you've got sci-fi horror movies in the 50s. Well, here's sci-fi and horror in the monsters. The mutant is a sci-fi monster. You know, I hadn't set out to do that specifically, but there they are battling. Sci-fi and horror are battling at the end. It's like the duel, the Titanic duel at the end of the universe there.
Oh, what a duel it was. It was amazing. Now, I have to ask that, you know, I loved the sequel. But we were teased that there was going to be a threequel with the Lost Skeleton Walks Among Us. Is there any hope?
Well, there's always hope. And that kind of leads me into something which I'm going to tell you about. I can say this because when this is heard, it will be after the date when I can announce it. So I can say this now, that we are doing a... We're not at Lost Skeleton 3 yet, but we are about to put out a Blu-ray of the Lost Skeleton Returns again with almost 2 hours worth of extras. There's a 40-minute behind-the-scenes making of some wonderful footage there. There's two new short films that I'm making, similar to a film that I made called a short I made called A World Without Lost Skeleton, which you can see on YouTube. I'm making two videos like that, and we're going to do a Kickstarter for this. And you know, I think that if this Blu-ray does well, we could lead to perhaps Blu-rays of my other movies, and who knows? I mean, maybe something like this will help get the attention or whatever's needed for a Lost Skeleton 3. We'll see. I'm always open-minded about number 3. But we're excited about the Blu-ray, and it's going to look phenomenal. So that's good.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I loved, you know, some of the lines in both the original Lost Skeleton and the sequel. Returns Again, were just great. I loved when they were out in the woods and Faye Masterson's character hears some noise and asks the ranger what it could be. And he says, oh, that sounds like something from the monster family. That whole little section right there, I really feel Blake should be using in the intro of this show. And I think this is the perfect time to ask for permission to use it because it's so perfect.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you do want to go that route, please do. Yes.
Awesome.
And, you know, mentioning Lost Skeleton Returns again, that is more of a monster movie than the first one. And I didn't want to do, you know, a sequel. It was more of the first one. So it's a very different, it's a jungle adventure, basically. And of course, it turns into color partway through the film, which was a fun thing to do. But the monsters in that, the two main monsters in that are the Graumenopodon and the Magraclaw. And they are each one of them is named in the scientific manner, and the other one is named in the more mythological manner. The Magraclaw sounds more mythological. Graumenopodon, I think, is sort of, you know, semi-scientific sounding name. I mean, it sounds like a prehistoric mammal name.
Yeah.
And again, that was something I didn't like intentionally do. I only thought about that after the fact, that their names sort of made one science based and the other mythology based. But I was very pleased with that movie. And I think, I'm glad we did something that was that different from the first one, you know, because I'm not crazy about sequels in general.
It's every time a good one comes out, people are like, oh, look, a good sequel. It's so rare. And then every time a bad one comes out, well, sequels are never good. So I don't really actually know what the stats are. But it's clear you at least love vintage movies, these old B-movies, 1950s styles. But how do you feel about modern movies? What are there movies you really are enjoying these days?
Yeah, I don't see everything that comes out. I mean, I don't see a whole lot. If something interests me, I go check it out. I think my favorite movie in recent years was a film called Triangle, which is truly strange. And I'm interested in films that really go somewhere different and aren't afraid to do that. Triangle was one of them. It's about 5-6 years old now, maybe. And I'm going to blank on the filmmaker's name. It's a British filmmaker, and I'm sorry, I can't remember his name.
Triangle is a 2009 film directed by Christopher Smith. No relation. A link to it will be in the show notes.
That was one that really stuck out for me. And there's another film called Coherence, which is really strange. I'm intrigued by high strangeness.
Yeah.
Does it really go somewhere weird in a subtle way? You know, that really intrigues me. I'm still catching up with movies. I saw Hugo the other day, which I'd never seen. It was pretty wonderful, you know. And I you know, it didn't sound great to me, but I'm glad I saw it. It was really good.
I actually wanted to ask about two things. First off, you were talking about naming these monsters in Lost Skeleton Returns again. I've noticed over all of your work that I've been exposed to, the names you come up with seem to be pulled from somewhere different. Do you have a formula? I mean, you got Stirpy Long Neuter and, you know, like Lattice and Crowbar. You've got just these really bizarre names. Do you have a formula for creating character names?
Yeah, it's the first and most important thing is does it sound good? Is it like, I think of billiard balls clicking together. Does it have a certain, are the consonants clicking together in a pleasing manner? And if they do that, then it can kind of sound like, hey, that might be a real name. I think I want it to be a ridiculous name that sounds like it could be real. You know, Trufanubin, who introduces the character that Andy Marsh plays.
Yes, I love Trufanubin.
Trufanubin. I mean, it sort of sounds right at first. And then you think about it. And it's, wait a minute, Trufin? No. No, that's, I think if there's a key, if there's a formula for me, I think it's that.
Well, you know, speaking of Trufanubin, all of the tales from the pub, I love them. And people need to go to YouTube and watch these. They're each about 2 minutes long. And they're just great. And they kind of, to me, they recall kind of like little shorts of like a Twilight Zone or The Outer Limits or Night Gallery or one of those old things. Mm-hmm. Was there a specific show you were kind of spoofing when you were making that series?
It I think the one it comes closest to is One Step Beyond, that John Newland hosted, and they're available on DVD. You can see these. And
not the Madness song.
No.
Welcome to the House of Fun, though.
and there's a little bit of Twilight Zone too. I think, for instance, the one called Puppet for Your Thoughts is maybe more of Twilight Zone than One Step Beyond.
Right.
But I think people think when they watch these too, I'm sure some people think that he's really making fun of these shows. But I love those shows. I really love those shows. So I my interest is in, again, absurdity. You know, they're like little outlets for being just really absurd and absurdist. I have a genuine fondness for those actual shows, but they were fun to do and they were great exercises because you got 2 minutes, you kind of in and out, you got to make your point. You got to make the story happen in two and a half minutes and that's it, which is a nice challenge. It's a nice filmmaking challenge.
Do you plan to ever create a movie that's actually set in modern times, or do you kind of feel like, the 50s is your medium?
No, after Lost Skeleton and the Cadaver, I mean, I was doing theater for years. I was a playwright for a number of years in the Boston area. The first thing I ever wrote was a dark Western, really dark. And I also wrote a very dark play about Irish gangs in 1890s New York City. And I wrote a science fiction piece called Interface, which was set in war times, kind of based on the alleged Philadelphia experiment. My point is that I'm all over the place. I mean, I love a lot of different stuff, but Lost Skeleton kind of got me into a kind of cubbyholed me a little bit there. And, you know, I followed up with another Lost Skeleton and Trail of Screaming Forehead and Dark and Stormy Night. So I'm kind of in that, but I'm doing all these other things. I co-wrote a film with my friend Kyle Rankin, called Witch Files. That you know Kyle, of course.
I know Kyle, yeah.
Yeah, and I co-wrote that with him. That's a modern day setting. There's a film I'd like to write later this year when I get some deadlines out of the way. That is also in a modern day setting, kind of a dark comedy. So, despite what it seems, you know, the labeling of Lost Skeleton, I like all this different stuff.
Yeah, it's great because I've seen a lot of your different stuff. And I want to mention to Blake, too. I don't know if Blake knows that Larry's got a lot of great artwork that's for sale. He'll often, you know, put stuff up for sale on whether it's Facebook or whatever. But he's also kind of available, I guess you could say, if you've got ideas for something that you would like to have turned into art. I used to love those old Magic or the Magician posters. You know, where they would have magician and like the little devils and stuff around their, you know, around their heads and stuff like that. And I contracted Larry to paint me in one of those, actually me and Brian. And it turned out so beautiful. It was absolutely amazing.
Thank you. That was such a fun gig. Really was.
Awesome.
Yeah. And the thing is people need to know that, you know, they can get a custom piece of artwork done that has Larry's name down at the bottom. And to me, that just makes it so valuable in itself. Hit him up on Facebook or something. If you've got an idea and you want to have him do some work for you, it's great stuff.
If you have a particular email or however you'd like to be contacted, we put that in the show notes too for contract work.
Oh yeah. The easiest way is I have two Facebook pages, the personal page and the public page. And anyone can, you know, I get messages through my public page all the time. And the same with Twitter too. So Twitter is, you know, I'm available on there. And those are the two best ways to reach me. Recently I've been doing some art for and writing for an RPG. Started it last year actually, and it's been kind of a long ongoing gig. And I've done a lot of writing for them too. And it's called They Came From Beneath the Sea.
Ooh, that sounds good.
And yeah, a very clever fellow named Matthew Dawkins got in touch with me, and he came up with this for Onyx Path. And I knew nothing about RPG. I still don't know a lot about role-playing games, but But nevertheless, I was able to do a lot of writing for it because it was 50s sci-fi stuff. That's sort of the base for it. And have had some real fun illustrating for them too. So that's been a nice gig.
But yeah, I love role-playing games. And there was a Call of Cthulhu is one of these role-playing games that I really like. It's based on H.P. Lovecraft's work. And they had a they had some modules that were, I think they were called Blood Brothers and Blood Brothers 2. And one of the ones, they were all basically movie kind of plot. So just, you know, various kinds of movies, but your characters would go through these scary scenarios, you know, based on a film type. And one of the ones they had was Mexican wrestling movies. And it was so awesome to be able to sort of play around with that idea. And that's the closest I've ever come to creating anything in this space. But it is neat how, you know, despite all the color and all the special effects improvements they've had over the years and all these other things, you can still have such a great time in that space. And, you know, those movies hold up well.
Yeah.
And your homage is, I think, it's a nice mixture of comedy and respect. Actually, unfortunately, as much as we like talking to you, this is supposed to be our last question. We like to finish up our interviews with this. It's really our signature question.
No.
I don't know if anyone prepared you or not, so give you a little time.
Actually, I've heard a couple of shows. So.
Okay, well, there you go. All right. What is your favorite monster?
Well, can I give you from two answers, which is one from movies and one from real life as far as we know it?
Sure.
Well, the one from the movies would have to be the Cyclops in the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Which the emoting there is just brilliant. The design of him or them, there's more than one, was like nothing before it, and it was copied somewhat afterwards, but I find that to be a wonderful, wonderful monster. And as far as monsters that may or may not exist, I just love the whole, you know, the Kelly Hopkinsville event in the 50s? You heard of
I
know
have
that?
Heard of this, yeah.
Well, that to me, I mean, is such a compelling story. The whole siege on the house, I mean, the imagery of it, whatever the truth behind it, it's a phenomenal tale. And so those might be my favorite monsters in real life.
I was probably understating it when I said I'd heard of it.
Yeah.
We did a 3-episode arc on it. It's been one of those monsters I've loved since I was a kid for the same reasons. And actually, I still haven't made I shot video of this, but I haven't put it together or put it online yet, and I need to. I did talk about this in Kentucky at CryptidCon last year. But what it is when back in the original casework around that, they one of the skeptical complaints about the whole thing was people thought that they, for some reason, skeptics thought that the family had not actually shot through the window screens. They had just, those were fake. They just poked a hole in the screen with sticks, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the complaints was that they were shooting out the window with a 20-gauge shotgun. You know, it should have made a bigger hole, you know, a different pattern. And then also they were shooting 22, but they said that could have just been done with a pencil. So I looked, and nobody had actually done this really simple experiment. So taking the notes for how far away the people were from the screen window, I just took a 20 gauge and a 22 out in the country and shot up a screen window.
Really?
Yeah. And it turns out that what they had in their screen perfectly matches what I got in my test. The 20 gauge blows a hole about 2 inches across from the distance that they were shooting.
And that blast pattern is going to increase the farther distance,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. It would. But at that distance, it's smaller than my fist. It's just a little punch hole. And I videotaped myself shooting this, and I have some nice, good, clear photos of that. Just kind of – so, you know, it doesn't prove anything except that it continues to support the fact that no matter what – was really going on, those people were terrified and were shooting out their window.
I don't think they were attacked by a gang of owls. That's my personal.
Well, you know, if there were owls, they probably weren't drunk. That's important.
And by the way, you know, you asked me about recent movies, and I want to mention I discovered Small Town Monsters last year.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I'm a Seth Breedlove fan.
Yeah.
I heard your show when Matthew asked me to be on here. I listened to that show. And just I'm a big fan of those that he's doing. I think it's great stuff.
Oh yeah, and I love the speaking of art. I love the poster art that they've put together. I've got one. I've actually got two on the wall up above me. The one for the Flatwoods is just beautiful. That is a great poster.
And can I just say his recreation of Flatwoods Monster on no budget was far superior to the show Blue Book that did just a terrible episode. It based on supposedly on the Flatwoods thing.
I don't even think they say, don't they say inspired? They don't even say based. It's like, that's, yeah. Uses words from actual cases.
Exactly, yeah.
Bless their hearts, as we say down here. So, well, Larry, it's been really great talking to you.
Thanks. Likewise. And I'm thrilled to actually to discover Monster Talk. I confess that I did not know about this, and I'm now a fan.
Awesome. Well, I bet we're going to have some new Lost Skeleton fans after this as well.
Cool.
So I wanted to ask really quickly: is there anything that you're working on right at the moment that you want to squeeze in real quick that we can be sure to mention?
Thanks. The RPG is ongoing, and they came from Beneath the Sea. If folks are into RPG and 50s sci-fi, definitely check that out. A lot of fun stuff there. And look for the Kickstarter, and there'll be an Indiegogo as for the Lost Skeleton Returns Again Blu-ray with almost 2 hours of extra, never-before-seen-before material.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and today you heard Matthew Baxter and me interview Larry Blamire, director, artist, and writer, about his work as an independent filmmaker and the creator of The Lost Skeleton of Kadavra, and much more. Check the show notes for links to the Kickstarter for the 10-year anniversary Blu-ray of The Lost Skeleton Returns Again. Hurry on over to that link if you want to get in on this, because there's not much time left. Monster Talk's an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thank you for making time for us in your busy, busy lives.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
Oh, say, you don't believe those old legends about the lost skeleton of Cadaver, do you?
Ranger Brad, I'm a scientist. I don't believe in anything.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.